This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 30, Episode 8. Coming up on the show, we've got interdimensional art connoisseurs, the true location of Sodom, and the continuing saga of the Mothman. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
Speaking of connoisseurs, I see your new title before was Misinformation Connoisseur.
That's right. Connie Nakamura Superfan.
You keep changing these behind my back.
I wanted to put you down as black belt in hate speech, but you wouldn't let me.
Because I don't want the cops kicking my door in.
Oh, that's right. It's illegal
in Australia.
We live in Australia. That's right. It's illegal.
It's illegal. Speech is illegal in Australia. You have to be very careful what you say. Although in saying that, we're going to be saying a few things on this episode that are probably very close to that line.
What do you got coming up?
Well,
there's nothing controversial about the Mothman.
No, nothing at all. Although in saying that, maybe there is, because a lot of people have, you know, very varied opinions about what Mothman is. And of course, you know, a lot of people, just when you talk to them in general about what Mothman is, most people probably think it's associated, even if they know about Mothman, it's associated with the collapse of the Silver Bridge over the Ohio River back in 1967.
And then you think about John Keel, you think about the Richard Gere film.
Exactly.
And a giant flying hairy thing.
Exactly. And all of that, and with brilliant red eyes. And all of that is very important when it comes to the phenomenon of Mothman. But essentially what happened is after that bridge collapsed, because it was such a tragedy, I mean, 46 people died. It was horrible. The town's attention, because there had been a build-up, it had been about a year, maybe a little bit longer, of really intense activity that was taking place in Point Pleasant there in West Virginia, where people were seeing UFOs in the sky, weird interdimensional creatures, poltergeist activity in their
homes. Men in black experiences,
men
strange
in black,
phone calls.
Yep, all that kind of stuff, all that high strangeness was occurring. It all came to an abrupt halt once the bridge collapsed, because everyone was focused on the tragedy. There's a lot of grief, obviously, and you know people were really distracted by it. So most people think that the whole Mothman stuff died down. It didn't. It didn't die down.
Well, you're saying it didn't go away.
The activity continued, and there were a couple of researchers that continued looking at the phenomenon for quite a long time, and people started coming forward in the decades later also describing their experiences. So, you know, out of interest, I just happened to get a pre-order come through from Nick Redfern. He's got this great new book called Mothman and Other Flying Monsters, Nuclear Nightmares and Armageddon. And it includes a few details that I want to go into about the continuing saga of the Mothman.
This is brand new, this one, isn't it? Just this week.
Yeah, this book is brand new. There's a few elements in here that I find to be particularly fascinating, especially surrounding a woman by the name of Susan Shepherd. You know, she's been heavily involved in this activity for quite a long time, but she's also like sadly she's passed away. I think she died in 2021. But she, you know, does, you know, ghost tours and that kind of stuff. But she presents this information about the Mothman to her groups that come through. And of course, that attracted the attention of some of these interdimensional interlopers, allegedly. So we'll go into that. But it also coincides with this fantastic documentary that we missed, actually, Ben. It came out in 2020. It was The Mothman Legacy. And this was directed by Seth Breedlove. And he's done a couple of documentaries before. I think we touched on the first one, which was the Mothman of Point Pleasant. He's also did the 2019 documentary, which is Terror in the Skies. But The Mothman Legacy actually talks about the continuation of the activity. So I've got some audio and some images also to show you, which will be
awesome.
In the show notes, but also on our YouTube channel if you want to check that out, where I'll be showing you how these people over the following decades have had both good and bad encounters with the Mothman.
Yeah, cool. Good stuff coming out.
Thank you. So what have you got coming
up? Well, speaking of the YouTube channel, I've got to say thank you to everyone who's left very heartwarming, positive comments, most along the lines of, I can't believe you guys are people. Like, you're real. Yeah.
Really nice guys. But yeah, I mean, you've been listening to us probably for 15 years. You think we've had the Podcaster 3000 running the whole time? The technology wasn't there.
But there's like 10 billion comments on the YouTube page, and not one of them is about the show that we actually did. It's all about, oh my God, you've got a beard.
Your comment to me was, I worked really hard on that segment.
I did. I worked my ass off on that show, and not a single comment was, oh, good story or anything like that. It was like, oh my God, I can see you.
I'm joking.
Thank you so much for the kind comments. It was really great to read them. So our YouTube channel is going gangbusters, and of course, Plus members can watch the video
directly through the website.
Yeah, on the website. I just want to mention this first up because there was a little bit of confusion still with some people as to where to find it. It's in the post. It's in the post for the podcast. Where you see the audio player, you got to actually click into the post and then just scroll down and you'll see the video. But I'm going in a bit of a different direction today because on the last Plus episode, we discovered that the ancient Olmecs, the Gulf of Mexico, the civilization that preceded the Mayans and the Aztecs, had potentially some link to a Chinese dynasty, to the Shang dynasty.
Yeah, yeah, controversial but fascinating.
Yeah, this incredible research that connect a kind of flood of refugees from, let's just say, an evil person in China at the time, and they all somehow made it to Mexico, and there's this connection with the Olmecs.
Well, they brought their yoga with them.
Yeah, and there's a great article by Bibu Dev Misra on our website. You'll see it up there on the front page today. But on that tip, I wanted to look at some more ancient history stuff, see if I could find some more controversial studies and finds.
So you went looking for Sodom?
I decided to go into Sodom, hardcore Sodom.
You decided to convert to sodomy?
Not directly, maybe indirectly for this episode. But yeah, I wanted to look into the research of Sodom, and I came across this really fascinating story. It's from Dr. Stephen Collins and Dr. Latane Scott. This came out in 2016, but this has been decades of research. It's called Discovering the City of Sodom, the fascinating true account of the discovery of the Old Testament's most infamous city.
Mm-hmm. Which was destroyed according to biblical law, right?
Well, yeah, you know the story where the two angels appear to Lot and Lot is in this deviant city of Sodom.
I just remember his wife being turned to a pillar of salt.
Yeah,
back.
The angels basically say, this place is rotten. We've been sent to destroy it. You need to get out of here. And yeah, classic woman moment. His wife turns. They tell her explicitly, don't look. She turns at the last minute and gets turned into a pillar of salt. And so obviously, you know, historians and archaeologists, they look at this element of the story and say, well, you know, this is some kind of moral message. This is just eloquently written to just portray the idea that if you don't live
to the hedonistic.
If you don't live to the high standards put down by God, you will be destroyed by God. And yeah, if you succumb to hedonism, you will be destroyed. And that's long been the view, even from biblical historians, that that's what the story is. It's a moral message. It's a metaphor. Mm. But along comes Dr. Stephen Collins, and he realized something about the Bible in particular. You can always rely on geography in the Bible. It's always, there's never anything made up about geography in the Bible. If something, they'll always tell you where something is. There's not some kind of made up name for a place. It is a real place. And so he started to look at the story of Sodom and realized there's all these markers in Genesis that tell you exactly where Sodom should be.
Really?
Now, at the time, there was this consensus that it was somewhere in the south near the Dead Sea, kind of the southern end of the Dead Sea. And he looked at the biblical pointers and realized this is wrong. That's not where it is. In fact, I know how to find it. This is what he said to himself and his colleagues. I know how to follow these markers in the biblical record and find this ancient city. And he did.
He found ruins, I'm assuming?
He found more than ruins. And coming up after the break in our Plus extension, I'm going to reveal precisely what he found and why he needed the expertise of someone who formerly worked on the Manhattan Project to figure out exactly what they had uncovered. That's coming up later in the show.
Okay, I'm looking forward to that. Let's jump into the saga of the Mothman. And as I said, I'll go through two sources. One will be, of course, Mothman and Other Flying Monsters, Nuclear Nightmares, and Armageddon, which I'm not actually going to go into. The whole nuclear nightmare stuff, I'm not really going to focus on too much.
Oh, well, that would have dovetailed nicely.
Well, maybe, perhaps, but I'm not entirely sure if it's true. And this is not a reflection upon Nick by any means at all. But back in 2017, there was quite the scandal within the paranormal community, I suppose, where there was alleged Mothman sightings all throughout the Chicago area.
And, oh, that's where they were just making them up, right?
Yeah, so the inside story from some of the contacts that we have, and I don't want to get involved, it's just, you know, people that have emailed me, you know, every now and again, have told me that they were able to match the IP addresses from where these independent reports were coming in, and they were coming in from the exact same IP address. And that's been also linked to a certain blog, and I was just like, okay, I don't want to get involved in that. But fascinatingly enough, Nick Redfern pointed out that around this time, he had a bunch of people that were contacting him about dreams that they were having. They were having these Armageddon-style dreams. And so these dreams were, you know, seeing you know, massive nuclear explosions across certain cities in the US and other locations as well. But there was a Mothman involved. Like, these people were having, which were disconnected. So this is a weird thing. You've got possibly this hoax occurring, right? But maybe generating some Tulpic-like energy or force, which was then kind of congealing with the fact that there's people all throughout America in 2017, there was a whole Rocket Man stuff that was going on.
Yeah, that's
right. You had
right.
North Korea firing missiles into the ocean over Japan. So people's, you know, senses were already heightened. Like, we were already stressed. And it seems like Mothman does seem to show up. And the style of Mothman, you know, he's also known as the Owl Man, you know, he's called Bat Squatch, you know, these entities, and they follow the same type of archetype. Like, it's this archetype of a humanoid winged creature that comes in a multitude of forms, but generally they have the same kind of structure, really. It's the large wings, the leathery wings, which are quite large, but not large enough to support the mass. So if it's a 7 foot tall being,
right,
but the wingspan is only 9 foot tall, we know from physics that that's not big enough to support the mass of something like that. And yet it does.
It's like the dinosaurs.
Flies.
It should not
fly. It's like the dinosaurs, right? And that comes up, you know, later on, is that around, you know, the 1970s, 1980s, people were seeing pterosaurs, you know, that were flying around. You know, we know that that's happened in Papua New Guinea as well. People reporting things, but they were much smaller.
But they're small, yeah. But the Papua New Guinea sightings, they're
exactly
like bird-like.
Suggesting that it was an actual species that has somehow survived. And yet the reports that have come from the UK, the Pennines, for example, you know, people have seen massive, you know, pterodactyl-style birds. Like, not birds, but I don't know what they are.
Flying creatures.
Flying creatures of some kind. So let me just give you some of the time frames. We'll come back to that in a moment. I want to give you some of the time frames of what has been occurring and how, you know, the activity of the Mothman didn't finish in 1967 with the collapse of the bridge. It's actually been going on for quite a long time. But the first confrontation that really showed up in the research happened on November the 12th in 1966. And this relates to a pair of grave diggers that were about 80 miles from Point Pleasant that encountered what was apparently the first sighting of the Mothman, this winged creature that flew above them, terrified them. They fled. And of course, they reported it, but this seemed to, you know, start the activity. And then from 1966 all the way through till December of 1967, activity in the area completely exploded. And like you pointed out, Ben, there was, you know, weird creatures that were being seen. There were UFOs. There were strange phone calls that people were getting. There was weird beings that were showing up in, you know, people's homes. And no one really knew what was going on, but it was quite disturbing. And it was generating more of this attention. It was like, I mean, these people that were reporting this stuff had no connections to each other. Even though the stories were getting around the neighborhood, these people were having their own experiences, which seemed to be completely independent, but had similar parallels as right. to what was going on. And it was all focused in this one area. And there's a lot of theories as to why this particular area in West Virginia was the center point for this activity. One idea was it was the confluence of rivers. So there's lots of stories out there that, you know, with the Native Americans, for example, they would bury their dead along the riverbanks. And those riverbanks apparently, you know, would carry energy through them, and that would move into certain locations. And you've heard that before with the idea of there being telluric currents and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Not directly connected to water, and there's no way to scientifically prove it, but there is an idea that water, as it starts to move in certain ways, it can generate this type of activity or can facilitate the appearance of this type of activity. So that's one idea. The other idea is that in 1774, there was this historic battle between Colonel Andrew Lewis and Shawnee Chief Cornstalk. I don't think some of the story apparently has been kind of blown out of proportion, But essentially, the chief cornstalk lost, but it was a terrible battle that took place. And we know with certain locations when there's horrible battles that occur and there's bloodshed and, you know, death and horribleness, that that also can stir up something that's going on.
Wasn't there the munitions factory nearby?
Well, that will come up in a moment. You're right, there was. It was known as the TNT area.
That's right.
And that's where a lot of us. So that was on the outskirts of Point Pleasant. And that had been set up a lot earlier, but during the Second World War, it was used for munitions manufacturing. And what's actually important to note with that is that a lot of people started seeing things that were coming out of that area. And there's a connection to the Lover's Lane phenomena as well. So, you know, there's those stories you've heard of people that, you know, they drive off into a Lover's Lane, a secluded location, you know, to make out and do whatever else. And that, you know, like a Bigfoot will show up, you know, peering through the window. And a bit of a peeping Tom, Bigfoot, that kind of stuff. The same thing was happening with Mothman, is that people were going into these isolated locations. Now, is it because the phenomenon was attracted to, you know, the lustful activity of the people? Or was it just simply because they went into an isolated area, they saw this kind of thing? And, you know, what some people have pointed out, particularly Susan Shepherd, you know, was that Point Pleasant was I dare say, and she says, a boring city. Like, it was a quiet, boring city. But when that happens, people tend to notice more. When something strange happens, they notice more. And I thought, yeah, that kind of makes sense.
I guess so, because they're not always entertained.
Yeah, well, when nothing's happening, you pay attention to strange stuff that's going on. You go looking for it. So, of course, you know, we have the fantastic book by John Keel, which was The Mothman Prophecies, and that came out in 1975. So that was, you know, 8 years after all the phenomenon, 9 years after all the phenomenon had taken place. John Keel, though, was at the epicenter of what was going on in the 1960s, you know, 1966, 1967. And he did write a little bit about it following, leaving Point Pleasant. Yeah, that's the book right there. So, The Mothman Prophecies, An Investigation to the Mysterious American Visits of the Infamous Feathery Garuda. And it just so happens that in this documentary, apparently John Keel intended to call the book The Year of the Garuda, right? But the publisher said, no, you can't call it that.
Because no one knows what a Garuda
exactly.
is.
Exactly. But a Garuda in Hindu lore is like a feathered humanoid creature, but also a harbinger of doom and tragedy. Mm. And that's almost seems like what happened in Point Pleasant, because with all this activity taking place, it ended with the accumulation of the collapse of that bridge and mass deaths. You know, it's quite a horrible thing to take place. But with everything that was going on, you know, it did attract a lot of attention. But apparently, it wasn't John Keel's book that really stirred up stuff. That was 1975. It was actually 1970, where 5 years prior, Gray Barker had published a book about Mothman. Now, Nick Redfern points out that, look, there's a lot of interesting details in that book from Gray Barker. But whereas John Keel tried to keep more even keel, forgive the pun, Gray Barker just grabbed every story and every crazy thing.
That was his style,
right?
That's what
he just ran with it. So you had to kind of dig through and find out, you know, the connections between these stories and, you know, what do you keep and what do you throw away? But when you look back through the literature, right, and globally as well, and this is what's really important to point out and what Nick focuses on in his book, is that Mothman-like creatures have been sighted for a really long time, going all the way back to the 17th century, you know, throughout the world. You've got Mothman-like creatures appearing in England in the 1800s. In 1903, in Pelsall, which is apparently just quite close to where Nick Redfern grew up, there was reports of horses being savagely killed, almost mutilation style, right? And no one knew what was going on. And obviously 1903, this is well before, you know, known cattle mutilations and that, you know, kind of category of attack was taking place. And there was this young man by the name of George Ajali. And he was, even though he had an alibi, he was found to be guilty and he was put away for a number of years until he was released in 1906 without being given a pardon or anything else. But the idea was that this guy was going around and attacking horses is absolutely insane. Like, it's the type of injuries that were happening to these horses suggested something that was non-human, but not any type of known animal or anything like that. And it just so happens that there were reports around the time coming out that people were seeing a large, malicious aviator that was responsible for this. So this is
a flying humanoid,
a Mothman-style entity in 1903. So then, of course, you know, you have the incredible reports that Jonathan Downs looked into, and Jonathan Downs is a great cryptozoological, you know, researcher. He looked into the events surrounding the Owlman, and that relates to 1976, where you've got In Cornwall and Devon, people witnessed this. Essentially, it was exactly as it sounds. An owl-style humanoid being that was flying about with large blazing coal eyes. It was extremely violent and had an owl-like face. Now, this image, which I'm going to put in the show notes, one of the first images, and you can see this on the screen as well. This is actually from the documentary, The Mothman Legacy. And these ones are just depictions of the Mothman. But this is essentially what people were seeing, right? And when you look at those eyes there, Ben, it really is bright, burning lights. So we'll come back to that one in a second. But these ones with these bright, burning lights. John Keel, when he published the Mothman Prophecies, and he spoke to a lot of people, and in fact, he stayed with the family of witnesses in the 1960s when this activity was taking place. But sometimes in the book, in the Mothman Prophecies, he described the encounters with these eyes as being like bicycle light reflectors or reflectors.
It's reminiscent of some of these so-called extraterrestrial encounters where they really do look like bright bulbs entity's head.
Well, exactly. Well, what I'm saying is like when John Keel turned it down. He was like, oh, no, it's like reflectors. So if you see a bicycle and you've just got a reflector, like a red reflector, and you flash a light against it, yeah, you see the light, but it's not extremely bright. But the truth is that, and this is after Nick has spoken to eyewitnesses and also, you know, the researchers in the Mothman Legacy, these witnesses have said, no, I don't know why John Keel said that. They were like burning electric bulbs.
Yeah, so it's not like eye shine.
It's not eye shine. It's internally lit. It's some type of electrical activity. In fact, there was one eyewitness that described it in a really fascinating way. He said that I'll play some audio coming up in a moment of someone who described something similar, but he said that everything about the body seemed to be flesh and blood, but the eyes were etheric. Like there was something about the eyes that it wasn't in this reality. And there's that old saying that the eyes are like the gateway to the soul and that kind of thing. So I wonder if there's something there, but I don't want to read into it too much. But going back to Jonathan Downs, right? So in the summer of 1976, you've got this owl man showing up. He's violent. He's got an owl-like face. In the 1980s, Jonathan Downs investigated this, but he stopped, right? Because there was an element to this phenomenon that wasn't just about the owl man and the sightings that people were having. It was about the fact that Jonathan experienced psychic backlash. And what he means by that is that when he started looking at the phenomenon, it started creating havoc in his life, very much like what happened to John Keel. And John Keel, you know, became quite disillusioned with what was going on. And that's what ultimately, and in the Mothman Legacies, the screenwriter for the Mothman Prophecies, the movie, kind of tries to get forward is that, look, John Keel got to the point where he didn't know what this was. People would ask him. They wanted to know what it was. And he just had to accept that he's never going to know completely what this thing was. And with Downs, right, he said that he lost, there's Jonathan Downs. Like he lost two cats, apparently, a dog. His wife left him. He had financial difficulties. It was all when he started looking into the owl man. And as soon as he stopped, that psychic backlash seemed to abate. And this is what happens to a lot of people. Look at this stuff. You know, sometimes people get off scot-free, like there's just not a problem at all. But for other people, depending on the phenomenon that you look at, it comes into your home, like it comes to you. And in fact, Susan Shepherd, you know, whose audio I'll play for you in a moment, you know, she had experiences. But preceding this, in her home, you know, when activity was taking place with the Mothman, poltergeist appeared in her home.
Yeah, right.
You know, and she said there were ceramic birds in her home and these ceramic birds would just suddenly fly off the shelves.
What?
And there'd be rappings and knocks and just...
They didn't actually start tweeting and flying.
Yeah, exactly.
They just got
knocked off. But the irony is that, yeah, the poltergeist seemed to target the bird and then, you know, chucked it across the room. But why? Like, was it just grabbing anything or was it actually targeting the bird to cause confusion? No one knows, but it wasn't just the Mothman. And this is something which is repeated throughout all of these stories, is that it's not just about the sighting. Like it holds more of an importance for the person, for the individual, because very much the whole Mothman saga and the Mothman prophecies did become about John Keel, right? It became about his experiences and what was going on. And as much as John Keel tried to remain objective, like he tried to remain objective with what was going on with the phenomenon, the intelligence behind the phenomenon deliberately tried to push his face up against the glass so that it became totally subjective to him, but also would have ruined any credibility that he had with it. And this is what it does, right? The intelligence doesn't want people to look at it scientifically, look at it subjectively and be like, well, you know, here's the facts, here's the details, here's what's going on. As soon as you get close enough, it grabs hold of you and it just pulls you in. And
how?
Because it starts causing that psychic backlash. It starts creating weirdness that's going on, like the weird phone calls that happened to John Keel. These men, the men in black that showed up and started hassling him and intimidating him. This is the kind of stuff that goes on.
So what Redfern's saying, this is all by design. It's some kind of subterfuge to make it seem more ridiculous.
Yeah, maybe. Well, that's not from Redfern. That's from the Mothman Legacy. And and this is from the screenwriter for the Mothman Prophecies, you know, and I tend to agree with that. I think it's, and I know a lot of John Keel's work, you know, I'm particularly fascinated. I've read almost everything that he's written. And he really is an intriguing man who I truly believe did try to remain objective about everything he researched, but it grabbed hold of him. It just pulled him in. And, you know, the guy by the end of it was completely disillusioned by it. And I understand why. But this is what happens with it, right? The Mothman stuff, even though it's a community kind of thing, where the entire community was being affected by this phenomenon, each and every individual that has an interaction with this thing, it seems to have like a personalized message for them or some type of personalized influence.
Examples.
On them. So let's get into some examples, okay? Let's just start off with just some of the classic stuff. So, you know, as I pointed out, that bridge collapse, 1967, essentially you had only Mary Heyer, and Mary Heyer was working for, there's the bridge there. Mary Heyer was working for a local newspaper. She had her column, and so she was continuing to monitor the activity that was going on. Well, guess what happened to her? She dropped dead a couple of years later from a sudden illness. And it's like,
what was the illness?
No one knows. It was just this sudden illness that came out of nowhere and she died. But while she was researching Mothman, she continued to publish reports of what people were experiencing with Mothman. Yet another person who has died when interacting with the phenomenon. But the phenomenon, right? People go, oh, well, no, it didn't occur. This is the audio of Lee Wilson. So Lee Wilson, and I want you to listen carefully because this happened to her in the summer of 1987. So this is decades after the Mothman attacks, you know, all the events took place. She doesn't know how to describe what she saw, but she saw something which is undoubtedly the return of the Mothman.
I was in Calhoun County, West Virginia, Leading Creek Road. It's outside of Grantsville, my aunt and uncle's old farmhouse. A few months before that, like in the spring, people were talking about like their chickens and stuff coming up missing, you know, overnight. But they would talk about weird noises, but no one had ever talked about actually seeing anything. The farmhouse, there's nothing around it. So there's no other residence for like a half a mile from the house that I was staying in. And it was probably 1987, 88, somewhere around there, summertime. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. I was just going to bed from after watching movies and stuff. And across the street from the farmhouse is a holler that goes up on the hill. And I started hearing this noise. You could tell it was some kind of, thought it was kind of a bird type thing. I thought maybe it was an owl or something, but it just kept getting closer and closer and louder and louder. The only way I can describe it is the Hollywood movies, the pterodactyl noises, you know, that's the only way I can describe it. It was that loud and that piercing, and it kind of had a giggling, loud giggling noise to it too. I mean, it's really hard to describe. By the time I sat up to look out the window, because I thought whatever this was going to fly right into the window, the wingspan of this covered the windows. And then when it got to that part of the house and went up over the house, you actually could hear it. You actually heard the sound. Again, not sure what I was going to do or what I just seen. Turned around to the back window of the bedroom, and you could see the shadow of whatever this was flying over the field to the back of the house.
So the thing is back. You've got cattle mutilations or alleged cattle mutilations that are taking place because there's chickens and farm animals that are disappearing. Unless she's read a lot about Mothman, the elements that she described in her experience fit many of those other cases. So you've got the weird giggling, like that sound of giggling. It's come up in other cases.
Really?
You've got the flapping of the wings, which she can hear as it goes over the house. The thing is deliberately trying to get your attention Because otherwise, like, why did she hear this howl? Like, she hears this howl. It doesn't start behaving in a certain way until she comes to the window. It's almost like it knows that she's looking out the window. And this is 1987.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Is there any large predatory birds in the area that this could be attributed
not
to?
Not this size, not like 7 foot tall, the type of thing that it is. Like, it's just too, it's far too big. So I want to go back to Susan Shepherd. So Susan Shepherd actually comes up in Nick's book, and, you know, obviously she comes up in this documentary as well, but she's quite integral to the Mothman encounters. But she describes something, it is described in greater detail in Nick's book, but I'll link to Nick's book so you can actually, you know, read all the full details for yourself. But in the documentary, she describes that, you know, when the Mothman sightings were taking place, something was happening around her home where it seemingly was focusing on her. Take a listen to what Susan has to say about an encounter she had in her home.
We live close to the Scarberries. I grew up on a hillside in West Union called Shannon's Knob. Late at night, it would sound like someone had jumped out of a helicopter. The roof would go boom, just like that. There would be a pause, and then these footsteps, somebody was walking on our roof. And they might be up there 10, 15 minutes, and the footsteps would stop as if something had flown away. And of course, my parents did not believe me, you know, when I kept telling them about these footsteps, until I woke up early one morning and I heard them talking to each other saying, "Wonder what those footsteps are on the roof."
So she went into it in greater detail in what she described to Nick.
It's creepy.
Oh, it's really creepy. And this thing would sit on the roof and it would stop. And like the parents would come up and check, and they wouldn't hear anything. And then, you know, they'd go away and then it would start again. It would creep across the roof. And as you heard in the audio there, that it would just take off, like it would just suddenly go. But she describes also that many years later, she looked into the history of the house, and it must have been because she was a researcher and, you know, there was word that crept around. But she found out almost a decade before they had moved into that home, like they'd left that home, that a babysitter one evening for the previous family that was living there had also heard some walking on the roof, right? Like, she was really freaked out. She didn't go to look. She didn't see what it was. She just heard this walking on the roof. So she calls the police and the police show up, and the police are like, "How the hell did that happen?" She's like, what? And they go outside and they've got the police officer holds a torch, and he just like points a torch up the side of the house, and up the side of the house is these mud footprints.
What the hell?
Yeah.
What, and actual footprint. Bird prints?
It doesn't say bird prints. It just said footprints.
Okay.
But those bird prints do come up in other reports, because you do have it that people said that they've seen tracks left behind allegedly of these things. And it does seem to be like those three-toed stork style, you know, footprints. But then other people have said that it's, you know, like a normal kind of, you know, shoed foot. There's all that kind of stuff that comes up in many of these reports. But it's just strange, right? But speaking of birds, you know, Susan Shepherd also points out that she had people come to her about their experiences. And another element of the bird imagery comes up from a witness that described it looked like its legs were the insectoid. Like, it was insectoid kind of style. Take a listen to this one.
We had that other sighting in Parkersburg of the girl having seen it on Quincy Hill. She said when she was in high school in 1987, she and her boyfriend were driving to the top of Quincy Hill, which is the highest location in Parkersburg. Something very similar. They saw this huge creature was walking across the street. She said it looked like a 6.5 foot insect. She said its knees were on backwards, you know, like an insect's leg, and had these huge wings as well. But she said the thing that stood out to her was this creature had a shuffling gait, like it was not used to walking on its feet. That told me she was telling the truth, because I had read a lot of the written accounts down in Point Pleasant. They all described the Mothman as walking that way.
Bizarre.
Did you hear what she said there? That it was like it wasn't used to walking on its feet.
Yeah.
So it's like, What does that mean? Does that mean that it normally flies? Is it just something that flies around all the time? Or is there something else going on? And this is what some people have speculated. And of course, you know, John Keel, you know, strongly speculated that these things are ultra-terrestrials and that they're not extraterrestrials, that they are a natural phenomenon of the Earth and that they're always here, but they're just possibly out of phase. You know, something was
different dimension.
Different dimension, or even it's not even a different dimension. They're just here and they just manifest into our visual spectrum every now and again. Like, we know that radio waves exist, but we can't see them. You know, but we didn't know radio waves existed previously, you know, hundreds of years ago. So is this the same kind of thing? That these things are some type of natural fauna, but then they seem to hone in on humanity though. They seem to tap into people more. So why is that? So with that personal message that comes with encounters of the Mothman, there's this very early report. You know, one of the earliest encounters comes from Marilyn Brokaw Hall. And, you know, she's a fascinating individual in that she was a young girl when the Mothman sightings were taking place. Many years later, obviously, when she met and married her husband, it was just kind of this, you know, funny coincidence that a husband was like, oh, when I was, you know, around that age, we were out hunting the Mothman,
really?
But down in another town. Because there were sightings in this other town. So for her, that kind of validated that, you know, people unconnected to her were seeing the same kind of things. So she sees the Mothman, but it seemingly is a harbinger of a disaster which is about to bestow upon her family.
Later in the summer, I was asleep one night. I heard something outside. I woke up. I went over to the window, looked out, and I saw red eyes in the yard. Whatever it was, could have been, I don't know, maybe 6 feet or more in height. And so I ran to my parents' bedroom. My dad, I told him I thought Mothman was outside, and he tried to tell me he didn't think that that was probably Mothman. Now, you know, like sometimes they'll say that Mothman's there to either mourn you or whatever. Like just a few months after I saw those red eyes, my dad was in an airplane accident. He was one of 16 people that survived. It happened in Cincinnati. It was flight TWA-128. It was a flight coming from San Diego, California, going to Boston, but it stopped in Cincinnati and there wasn't enough runway for the jet. And so it went on and went into a orchard and caught on fire and just like threw people out of the plane all over the place. My dad, the seat that he was in, the seat right beside him was on fire. And there was a husband and wife behind him. Wife was killed, and my dad turned around and grabbed this guy by the hand and said, if you want to live, come with me.
How incredible is that? Now,
you always come back to this question, though. Is this a coincidence, or
yeah,
is there some fate? Is there some kind of destiny in that person's life, and it creates the right environment for this archetypal entity to appear? I mean, what's the purpose behind it?
That's a really good question. And, you know, it's been speculated in the documentary itself is that maybe there's some type of, you know, like folkloric kind of phenomenon that's taking place here. Because if you look back throughout, you know, folkloric legends, both with the Native Americans of what occurred around that time, the Celts, the Scots, the English, you know, all the Celtics as they came over, they had all this folklore, and the folklore has been around for a long time. You've got the Wailing Banshee with the Welsh. You've got, you know, Irish reports of similar types of beings, and it's all folkloric, right? It's all some type of legend. But guess what they have? They have fiery red eyes and they're harbingers of doom. And it's like, if one of these things comes up to the window of your home, you have to be fearful that it's going to bring about some type of, or it's like, it's not bringing about the disaster itself, but it's announcing the disaster, which is going to be bestowed upon your family or upon someone close to you. So is the Mothman some type of modern manifestation of that? Is it that somehow the family, you know, because they were going to be, the father was going to be involved in that plane crash, that this thing showed up? But then why is it that there's other reports going on? Is it because the bridge was going to collapse? So already there was a lot of activity that was centered there, and it was just coincidental that her father was going to be involved in something. There's all these questions, and you can really lead yourself down this, you know, rabbit warren of theories, and you can really get quite, you know, lost and, you know, adrift, you know, at sea with this kind of stuff. But you have to kind of pull yourself back for a moment and take a look at the stories, you know, collectively and see what's going on. Because sometimes also the phenomenon can, it was described in this fashion of imagining it being like a form of like a static energy. And it just floats around. It's around us all the time. You know, it just moves about. But this static energy, when you encounter it, when you run into it, your brain, your filter, essentially, your psychic filter interprets it in different ways. And for some people, you know, they interpret it as a premonition. For some people, they interpret it as some type of, you know, scary entity like the Mothman. For other people, they have some type of UFO experience. It's because it's a natural energy which is here, but it permits us to access the knowledge which is universal, right?
So it's this whole idea that your mind creates this. Why would people's create a giant hairy owl creature? Why would people's minds create a flying UFO?
Well, the thing is, why would your mind create, like, why would for multiple people in that one area all create the same entity? If it was just some energy that was floating around an area and you were independently, you know, somehow inferring what's going on, why is it you have clusters of people seeing the same thing? I would assume that we all have very different, you know, biochemistries, neurochemistries, if that's what's influencing it.
Yeah, the fact that multiple people are seeing the same thing and the attributes match to certain degrees suggests that it is a unique, objective, existing thing.
I think
not some ephemeral mental state that's projected from eyewitnesses.
Exactly. I still think that it's some type of archetype which does serve as a warning. Like, I think it's maybe tied in with possibly fate, perhaps. Like, it's
Look at the archetype of the Grim Reaper, mm-hmm. right? It represents death. But the Grim Reaper has a task, and its task is to take the living to the realm of the dead.
Yeah.
And it's an archetype you see in the West. But it's the idea is that it's an entity with a role. It's an entity with a job. So
it's a ghastly vocation.
If you look at that in terms of the Mothman, perhaps that's its vocation. That's its role. It's to essentially announce disaster. And perhaps it even causes the disaster. Now, you might think, well, is this some kind of demon? Is it some kind of evil thing? Perhaps that's one way to look at it, but I mean, things happen for various reasons. There's karmic reasons behind all happenings in the universe, right?
That's a good point, yeah.
So maybe this entity's task, its role, is to just ensure that destiny plays out the way it plays out.
I'm really pleased that you went there, because this is what I've been trying to lead up to. This is my theory as to what's going on. I think that Mothman is essentially a manifestation of an entity that acts to police reality. Like, it's kind of, because it's tied in with the Men in Black. And what are the stories about Men in Black? The Men in Black step in and they tell you not to talk about this, and they seemingly are policing people's interactions with the phenomenon. I think the Mothman is exactly the same kind of thing, because some people describe really positive experiences with Mothman.
Really?
People have, you know, their lives are saved. And, you know, you can infer from even that report with Marilyn there that, well, was her father's life somehow saved? I mean, the seat next to him was on fire and the people behind him got killed. You know, it's like, is that what occurred?
There was that really short book I showed you before we started recording. It's only about 113 pages, that little paperback book. I can't remember the name of the author, but she was an eyewitness of Mothman when she was young.
Was it Mothman in the Moonlight or something?
Something like that. Very short
I didn't get
experience.
A chance to go
but
through it.
The reason I mention it is her takeaway, her conclusion after everything. And she saw this golden light. She actually saw a flying saucer. And she saw,
like many people do,
she saw the Mothman after the flying saucer, which is intriguing. But she seemed to think that it was a protector. It actually protected her from the disaster.
Yep. Yeah, and on the other side of the coin, right, you have people that describe Mothman as being like the devil incarnate. So there was one woman, and I just think it was because she was terrified. I don't think it's what the Mothman actually did, but she was outside holding her infant, and the Mothman swooped down upon her, and she dropped the infant and then fell on it. Now, I don't know what happened in the end of that story. I think the baby was okay. Yeah, and it was like, oh, well, there was the devil. I'm like, no, lady. I mean, I know you're terrified, but you dropped your kid. Like, where's your parenting instincts there?
It is a giant 7-foot tall, hairy monster.
I know. I mean, that's true. I mean, I guess
it's not like, you know, a raccoon or something.
Yeah, but and that's the recurring thing with a lot of these people. Like, they have this multiple swoops of this kind of thing, like driving along remote roads and, you know, being swooped 6 or 7 times for some people. But you can see the difference, right? So you've got someone saying that their life was saved. And then you've got another person saying that it looked like the devil. Like, this is how terrifying it was. But then you have these weird temporal connections that come up. Like there's some type of connection through time, through family members. And of course, you know, this is the kind of stuff that happens with ET abduction reports. So you've got Ron Latham here. Ron Latham, back in the, I think it was the 80s or the 90s, he too was in this area. He was driving home one evening and he saw this creature.
I've been going over it in my head and this is pretty much how it went. We were coming home. It was either 1999 or 2000. We're coming home and it was late in the evening. We're coming around the first curve, and the first curve will be near a graveyard, actually. It's an old family graveyard. It's up on a hill there. And as we're around the curve, we slowed down, and the headlights hit something in the road. What they hit was a form. And for a split second, I thought, oh, it's a large bird in the middle of the road. And then we're sitting there, you know, and this thing, whatever it was, you notice really quickly it's not a bird because you can kind of almost see through it. It has this weird, not translucent, but almost like it was phasing or shifting. It kind of stands up a little bit and puts out what I assumed were wings, I mean, arms, something. And they reached almost the sides of the road. But with just one movement, it shot straight up. And as it's shooting straight up, you know, we're sitting there and you could hear it and you could see it too. There were twigs falling. You know, it made no sense. The speed at which it moved, I have no idea. Now, I never thought for one second when this happened, by the way, you know, that was Mothman or that was something. Nope, what I felt was absolute 100% fear, terror. I hit the gas as hard as I possibly could. I don't think I've ever got that car to go as fast as I did that night. And it's weird about that, and I look back at it to this day, but something said, get out. And I got out. Yeah, it was pretty scary.
You think?
So phasing or shift, here would you describe the eyes? And you could see, yeah, because he's like, it wasn't that it was necessarily transparent, but he could see through it. And it was like phasing or shifting. Again, you know, leaning towards the idea that this is some type of potential interdimensional or, you know, a being that is an ultra-terrestrial, that it can somehow phase in and out of our reality. But that wasn't the end of the story, right? So after he sees this thing, and I'm sorry, I got the date wrong there. So that was 1999, 2000 that he saw this thing.
This is Ron Latham.
That's right.
You said Latham.
Oh, Latham, sorry, Latham. So years later, though, it kind of came back to him. He's like, hang on a second. That exact road where I was, my mother had an experience there, very close to there, in the 1950s.
Really?
But what is really weird about the story is not my sighting. It's the part that gets me is it, where it happened is only about just maybe a couple hundred yards from where my mom had a sighting, and that would have been in the 50s. And her and four other people at the time had seen what they described as a gray ghost. They were walking along the ridgeline at the time. They said that this gray thing appeared near the graveyard, and to them, it just went up in the air. That was their words. It went up in the air.
So it's the same thing, except a different form. See, like the depiction.
What are the odds of another family member seeing it, though?
Well, it depends. I mean, if this thing is endemic to the area, well, then perhaps high. Or is it that it was focusing on them through generational lines? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, this is the same thing you hear with alien abductions.
All the time.
And other strange entity encounters. It does seem to follow people in the family.
So
what's the connection?
Exactly. What's the connection? What's going on? So before I play the next piece of audio for you, which is actually a story that which was repeated by Jeff Walmsley. So Jeff Walmsley is the curator of the Mothman Museum in Point Pleasant. And he, I think, is one of the creators and you know, a person who keeps the Mothman Festival? Like he keeps that going every year. You know, and that's kind of revitalized the town as well, because you do have people obviously going to this location because it has got this cult following about it now. But he describes a story that happened to Linda Scarsbury. And I want to come back to her. Let me just tell you a little bit about her details. So Linda Scarsbury is in a roundabout way connected to a man by the name of Merle Partridge. Now, Merle Partridge, he had this encounter on November the 15th, 1966. And he was sitting in his house and he heard his dog going crazy. You know, it's a very typical kind of, you know, experience that happens with these people. his dog goes crazy and he's like looking out and he's looking over to the barn and he's like, what the hell? Why is the dog going crazy? So he goes over to the barn and the dog, you know, kind of is yapping at the door and he pulls the door open and he sees essentially what is a Mothman. Like the exact details are described in Nick's book, but he essentially sees the Mothman. And for whatever reason, you know, it's got those red eyes. And for whatever reason, the guy just kind of like lets the dog in and then just closes the door. And it's like, I don't know, were you being controlled? Like if I saw a Mothman in my barn, I would be pretty freaked out. But this dog was a German Shepherd,
the least.
Right? So he just closes. I think like he let the dog be able to leave, but he wanders back into his house. And the following morning he gets up and he can't find his dog. Like his dog is nowhere to be found. So it's all very odd, right? But then you have on that same evening, you've got Roger and Linda Scarsbury, who were at the TNT plant on the city outskirts, and they encountered the Mothman as well, right? On that same evening, they encounter the Mothman. They're freaked out by it. They go driving rapidly off to the police station. The police come out and inspect their vehicle. They find that there are scratches in the car door, like that actually something has scratched their vehicle, which obviously wasn't them. It was like claw marks in the door. But what she recalls is that when they were fleeing, they drove under this billboard. So they had a big billboard up. And as they drove under it, this Mothman thing perched itself on top of the billboard with these glowing, bright, electric red eyes. And she said that when she looked under it, there was a dog. Like there was a large dead dog underneath it that was a German Shepherd.
Or in its claws or something.
Well, not in its claws. It was just lying underneath it, underneath the billboard, like it had been dropped. And it's like, is this the connection? Did this Mothman creature take the dog and then drop it at its next site back at the TNT plant? You know, who knows what's going on? But that wasn't the only encounter of Linda. So later on, and this comes back to, well, what the hell is this thing? Because that's truly terrifying. That's horrible. Like clearly this thing's going around killing animals, killing pets. Like it must be really dreadful. But Linda came to this idea that this was actually some type of creature that was possibly interdimensional, but it was stuck here. It had passed into our reality and she felt a sympathy for it. She said there was a sympathy that she felt for it because it was like it had no way of calling for help and no way of communicating.
Oh, the poor baby.
And listen to this.
Oh my God.
And listen to this experience of one evening when she moves into an apartment and she looks at her window.
After Linda Scarberry, her initial sightings in 66, you know, for years after, she told me and others that, you know, weird things happened in her house. She always had this premonition of something watching her. In later years, she lived in the downtown area in an apartment above just a vacant building or whatever.
She said it was winter. It was like really, really cold, like January. And she heard a thump. And she had one of those roof lines like came right up to the window, two-story house, and said she opened up the window and she looked and it was sitting there. And it was cold and it was shivering and it had taken its wings and wrapped around itself.
A few years after that, I found the newspaper clipping of a police officer in Charleston, West Virginia, who took a phone call from someone who was looking out their window to the roof beside of their house. And they described it the exact same way. And the police officer said, you know, what is it doing and where's it at? And the person said, it's sitting on our roof, just right outside of our window, and I'm staring at it.
It was cold, man. Oh. It wrapped its arms around itself, its wings around itself.
Poor little guy.
I feel so bad
for
it.
He needs a home.
Yeah. Well, maybe it needs to be obliterated. Either way, you know,
it needs to be set on fire.
Yeah, set it on fire.
Set back to hell.
Yeah, that's a way to deal with it. But you know, what's fascinating about this is that you see these little connections. So then, yeah, you've got, you know, years later, a newspaper report confirming that a woman that was in the vicinity also looked at her window and called the police because she had seen the thing. So what Linda's describing, it seems like, is a genuine experience. Like she really did see this thing because there were other people that validated that. But with the experiences of that dog disappearing, right, this is back on November the 15th, 12 days before this, a really strange element to the entire Mothman phenomenon occurred. So this was on November of 1966. That's when Woodrow Derenberger met Ingrid Kolt, right? So Ingrid Kolt, sorry. Derenberger, right. I'm stuffing up these names today. But essentially, like, that story is a well-known story. I'll link to it in the show notes so you can check it out. The reason why I mention it, though, is because it plays an important role later on for Susan Shepherd. So essentially with that is that when this Derenberger was, was driving along. UFO comes over the top, it lands in front of him. Out climbs this awkward kind of man with this massive grin on his face. And he was wearing, I think, like a suit, just a normal kind of suit. But underneath it, you could see that he had some type of like a spacesuit type clothing of some kind. And he telepathically communicated with him and, you know, kind of just had this conversation, a very bland conversation. And then left. Like when the conversation got boring, he just left. And there's a lot of other elements that come up in it. But he became known as the Grinning Man. And then later on, the story became really absurd because Derenberger claimed that he was impregnated and taken to another planet. And it just became like ridiculous, like absolutely
ridiculous.
Yeah,
his initial story sounded believable.
Plausible.
But it's like he had pressure to add on to it and keep the story going.
Yeah, but some say that that's actually part of it, that the phenomenon does that to you. It deliberately tries to make you look insane so that no one believes your story. But none of that is really important. It's about what happened many, many years later with Susan, right? So Susan, this is what she reported to Nick when she, you know, handed over all these pages and pages and pages of documents. So in the 1960s, like 1967, she had that poltergeist activity in her home. There were footsteps on the roof. So that audio that I played before with the footsteps on the roof, that continued until the 1970s. That's how long that activity went on for. And in 2006, Nick ended up speaking to Merle. So Merle was the guy whose dog, you know, disappeared. And Merle's like, yeah, I spoke to John Keel. I told him about these events that took place. I don't know why he changed my name for the book. Apparently he changed his name. But he says there's two incidents that, you know, I want to mention. And one is that I got this knock at the door one day and it was a man that was like really distressed. And I asked him what was wrong. And he said, look, I was just driving along and my car started playing up. And I looked to the side and my son's gone. Like my son just is not in the car. He was driving with his son and his son was just gone. This is all around the time of the activity taking place, right?
So the son didn't jump out.
Doors were closed. It was locked. The windows were up. You know, you would notice like your kid's right there and his son
in the back seat or
next to him, like right next, and kid's gone, right?
How old was the kid?
Young, I think like 10, you know, something like that, maybe 12. And so, they all go out searching for him and they find this kid, you know, a couple of hours later, and he's just wandering about in a daze up the road, but he's coming from the opposite direction of where the car was. And he kind of wanders out and he's like, what happened? And he's like, I don't know. He was just essentially teleported
bizarre
out of the car around the time all this stuff is happening. Right. And it happens that this guy showed up at Merle's home decades later, like 35 years later, knocked on his door. And he's like, I'm the young boy that disappeared that day. And I still do not recollect what happened. I have no recollection of what happened. But Merle points out, he's like, after that, you know, weird encounter with this missing kid, you know, he was later driving a truck, right. And that was his job. And as he was driving this truck, while all this activity is going crazy and all this stuff is occurring, he says he suddenly feels overwhelmed, like a sudden extreme lethargy and tiredness, and the soporific effect of the road is just too much for him. You know, he has to sleep. So he pulls over to the side of the road and he falls asleep. It's like he has no control over it. It's beyond just simply being tired. It's like you're being induced. It's like going under anesthesia. And he says when he wakes up, it's the weirdest thing because he's covered in a substance that's like cobwebs. It's like massive amounts of them. Not like it's just like a couple of spiders have been in the truck and have laid a cobweb. Like this massive amounts of these cobwebs are all over him. And he's like, what is it with this? Like what's the phenomenon doing? Why is it toying with people? Why does it play with people? But it just highlights like the really strange elements that it wasn't just Mothman. Like Mothman seemed to be the central point that everyone was focusing on. But for some individuals, they were having these really odd high strangeness experiences. But why? And why were they connecting to other events that people were having? It was this puzzle, this game that was being played where people were trying to work out what was going on, but never getting anywhere. And that's ultimately what happened to John Keel. Like he never got anywhere with it. But going back to Susan, right? So Susan says that in August of 2001, she was running these like, I don't know if it's a ghost tour, but something like that, something along those lines. And obviously she started incorporating the stories about cold and, you know, the Mothman elements into it. And people were fascinated by this stuff. And she says in August of 2001, this guy, this awkward, weird man by the name of Billy, B-I-L-L-I, shows up.
That's right? Not how you spell Billy.
No, but it's Billy. Like he shows up and he is completely obsessed with her in the way that he shows up to every single presentation she does. He's always there. And for whatever reason, Susan just gets it in her head that she's like, oh my God, that's cold. Like, it's, that's cold. And she's sure of it, right?
It's Indrid cold.
It's Indrid cold. It's the same
from Lanulos.
Yeah, from like from this other planet, right? And she's like, oh my God. And this thing starts essentially stalking her. And he shows up at, you know, every presentation she does. It's Thanksgiving time. And when it's Thanksgiving, she goes to, she sits down and then her daughter's there. And then this entity, this Billy, he just sits down in the next seat.
Does she ever speak to him?
Oh, yeah. She talks to him and he's just acting like he's just really fascinated with her work, right? And as he sits down, the daughter later on goes, he was wearing like a weird waterproof like suit or something underneath his clothes.
What the hell?
Like cold. Like it's the same kind of thing. And she's just like, it's never really told to how she knows it's cold, but she does. She's like, either this guy is immortal or he's ageless, but it's the same guy. And so she starts, guess what starts happening to her? It's 2 o'clock in the morning. She picks up the phone and it's this, hiya! And then just hangs up, right? And she's like, she hangs up, but she's so freaked out by it. That's exactly what it is. It's this long hiya that comes through in almost a robotic kind of voice. And she slams the phone down and she's like really freaked out. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. She's like, what the hell's going on? She's like, oh, no, no. I'm going to start.
It's like a prank call.
Right. So she's like, I'm going to star 69 this. So she star 69s it and she gets the number. And it's a number that's from, you know, Point Pleasant or something. And she knows, because she's not too far away. And she knows only two people that would be there. She's like, oh, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Should I call them back? She's like, it's not them. Like, it's not their number. But she's like, no, that you called me and did something really weird. So she calls back. It's not more than 5 minutes after this, right? She calls. Guess you know exactly what happens. When she calls that number, what does she get?
Pizza Hut.
The number's disconnected. The number's no longer in service. 5 minutes. Like it's 5 minutes is that. So you can go, you know, like that could be a crank call. You know, what does it have to do? But this is what Keel was experiencing, right? These weird metallic voiced phone calls. It's all kind of repeating. So then later on.
Were the other calls like a long high-pitched hire as well at 2 a.m?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, yeah. Well, but not just her, but also her friends, which I'll describe, right? So what happens though is that Billy, she has this art auction. So it's after the Thanksgiving play. And it's a little bit later. And she has this art auction where she does her art and then it was being sold off. And she says, Billy shows up with this busty space blonde. Like it's another person who clearly is just odd. And but all like an image of what, you know, 1950s, like attractive space women, like what that would be. And so she's all dolled up, but, you know, big red lipstick, you know, with like cone like Madonna tits sticking wow. out. Like it's
the Bill Tompkins Pleiadians. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it's exactly like that. And she's like, why are her tits like cones? It was all like really bizarre, right? And she doesn't make any, because she's freaked out. She doesn't want to get close to Billy. Like she's really freaked out. She's like, she talks to one of her friends and she's like, can you find out? Like that's him. That's Billy, that's cold. But can you find out what he's doing? And she's like, yeah, yeah, sure. So the friend watches and an art auction goes on downstairs where her piece comes up. And as soon as her piece comes up, Billy's just like, $100 million. Like he just wanted that amount, but he just keeps on going. Like he just keeps on going. And the price just keeps on going and he wins. He wins this art piece, right? And the friend, now Susan doesn't see this. She doesn't know about it. She only finds out later on when her friend calls her upstairs. And friend's like, that was really weird. She's like, why? Why was that really weird? And she's like, when he won it, like when he got it, he hands over the money. He then grabs hold of the art piece and clutches it around his like his torso and then runs from the building with this look of glee and excitement on his face with his busty corn, like cone tit blonde by his side. And they get out of there.
Bizarre.
And she's just like, I've got this weird feeling. I don't know how. But is my art being admired by a bunch of aliens on this planet? You know, is that what was going on? Did they get like a prize?
She's like a celebrity. Prized.
Yeah. It's like she's this celebrity. It's just
on planet Gok, she's the number one celebrity.
It's so surreal and so weird, but it's yet another example, another person. And what I really like about her writings is it doesn't appear to me, and even from that audio, like only it's a short snippets, right? But when you look in the documentary, some people, when they're in the paranormal, they make it all about them. Some people in the paranormal are like, oh, it's all focused on me. It's all very important, my experience. I don't feel like that's with her at all. Like, I get this impression that it's like she was just reporting what was going on. But for so many people, that's kind of the line where it does become personal and it does start, you know, attacking you. I shouldn't even say attacking, but perhaps attaching to you. and causing influence in your life. And I feel like that's what was happening, because she wasn't making out like this is a fun, exciting, attention-seeking thing. She was going, what the hell is going on? This is extremely weird. And it continues, right? So later on, she said that she had a friend by the name of Virginia who just had a new phone. And they were sitting at dinner one day. And for whatever reason, I think this man, Billy, had popped into her head or it had come up. And her friend had this new phone and, you know, she didn't know how to use it. And so she gets this phone call and somehow it comes up and the number comes up 111-111-1111. And she's like, that's odd. Like, that's really strange. Oh, well. And she kind of puts her phone into a purse and forgets about it. Later on that night, she just happens to call up Susan. And she's like, oh, you know, and not knowing anything about what had happened to Virginia before, she's like, oh, I managed to get my phone to work. And even though that was a 111-111-111 number, someone left a voicemail. And Susan's like, oh, yeah, what was the voicemail? And she's like, oh, it was a weird metallic voice going, hiya!
Oh, my gosh.
And it was like,
bizarre.
What the hell? Like, what the hell? So then, right, you can go, okay, this is bizarre. And, you know, maybe she's just reading into things too much. It's not until 2006, right? 2006, her mother has an operation for something that was wrong with her esophagus. And she doesn't do too well. So she's quite sick. And she's at her mother's place with her sister when there's a knock at the door. And Susan's exhausted. So she's sleeping upstairs. And her sister opens the door. And she says, there's two men in black, classic men in black, that are standing at the front door. And they're like, and like all awkward and all weird.
Can we have Susan a home? Drink of water?
Yeah, no. Is Susan home? And she's like, oh, yeah, but she's just been dealing with my mom and she's asleep now. I'm like, oh, well. And apparently it's awkward. Like, it wasn't like, okay, you can leave now. And she says she looks over there because they tried, like, they were looking around. Like, they were trying to look if they can get into the house. And the sister looks over their shoulders and she says there's two other men in black up the driveway waiting as well.
Can she see a vehicle?
Yeah, there's a vehicle. There's a nondescript black vehicle, right? And she's like, oh, no, I'm sorry. Like, you can't see her at the moment. And he says, don't worry. Tell her we will visit again. Now, this is something that Cold and other beings, other entities that people have interacted with during the time of the Mothman sightings had said exactly the same phrase. Don't worry, we will visit again. And the sister shuts the door and she's freaked out by this. And she looks out the window and she watches them get into this nondescript men in black vehicle and drive away. But the funny thing is, like, right after this incident, Billy completely vanished. He was never seen again. He'd shown up, all this high strangeness, all these weird phone calls from dodgy numbers, everything just abruptly stopped and no one knows why. And then she sadly passed away in 2001. Now, I'm not saying that there is a connection there, but with all the other reports of people describing that they're, you know, Mothman and these entities are harbingers of doom of some kind, is there a connection? Did she suffer some type of psychic backlash or is it just completely, you know, a baffling coincidence?
Surely someone could look into this guy and figure out who he was. There must be records of him being around at this time. You know, did he buy tickets to go to these events that she was at?
That's a good point. I mean,
is there receipts?
2001, so maybe there were, you know, we're starting to have digital records for more stuff. I really don't know. And you know what though? I kind of don't, like, I don't want someone to look into that because of what happened to her and, you know, what's happened to other people. I don't know if digging into that is necessarily a good idea. You know, it could be quite a dangerous thing to do. But let's go back to the Mothman legacy. And I just want to play a few more tracks for you because it kind of continues this theme of what's going on. So now I want to play for you the story of Jack Patrick. So Jack Patrick also in the decades following this had a very strange encounter when he was walking past an abandoned house one day.
I would say I was probably 10, 11 at the time. And the hollow that we lived in, like the last street light, was probably, I'd say, 100 feet away from where the house was that I saw the Mothman. I knew to be home before dark, but I wasn't. So when I was pushing my bike up the holler, the asphalt and the gravel started, that's where that house was. That house was abandoned. The guy that lived there, he got killed in the coal mines. And I happened to hear a noise, and I just happened to look over, and I seen something standing in the doorway that had red eyes. It was really tall. I really remember the eyes, like the reddest red you ever see. He was at least 7 foot tall. And so I started crying, and I felt like I stood there crying and looking at it for like at least 15 minutes. And here come my brother's friend, actually, out of the holler. He seen it too. He picked up a rock, threw it at it, and it just kind of vanished.
it vanished just by simply throwing a rock at it, right? So it's not physical. And the friends saw it, so it's not
it can
an hallucination.
Physical.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of like this weird, you know, wave or you know, what's it, was it a wave
particle
or a particle?
Or a wave, yeah,
exactly.
In a quantum state.
It's a quantum state, right? But the story doesn't end there because they went back to the abandoned house down into the basement. And this is exactly the same thing we were talking about recently with the tracks left by the paranormal.
I would say probably maybe a year later that me and one of my buddies went in that house, and there was we went in the basement part, and there was these weird footprints. It looked like they was burnt into the concrete. Best I can describe it, they was in a Y shape, and like they had black around them, like they got hot.
Three-toed bird-like footprints burnt into the concrete. Do you know how hard it is to burn stuff into concrete?
Yeah. Where did you get this image? Is that what he's talking about?
That I took directly from the documentary. So, and that, because it looks like
they- Is it a photo or they just
Polaroids.
Recreated it?
No, I think it's, it looked like it was Polaroids. So if that is not
that's
a recreation-
That's a bird foot right there.
That's, yeah, it's pretty, but you know what though? So it just so happens that Paul Sieben published an article on our site years ago, like back in 2018, where he describes like a new take on the Phantom Hitchhiker kind of thing. And this happened, I don't know exactly when it occurred, but it happened on February the 26th. I don't know what year it is. I'm sorry. I don't know when that occurred. But it happened to Pedro Pironi. And Pedro describes that he was driving along this road one evening. And as he drives along, he picks up this kid. And this kid was wearing clothes were like that of someone who goes to an industrial school. And he asked me to take him down to the cemetery crossing. Again, like the crossing, you know, linked in with paranormal stuff. He says, as soon as he gets out of the truck, like this kid, he just drops the kid off. He smells this awful burning smell. And he thinks that there's something on fire and he looks around.
Sulfur?
Maybe, but it's not described. He just says it's burning, but he looks down and his floor mats have been melted.
Oh my God.
By the kid's feet. There's
what?
Like two footprints that are melted into the mats. And of course he's looking around ready to yell at this kid because he's just, you know, burnt his you know, mats. Like it's a road. There's no way you can go. It's like a wide open space. This kid's nowhere to be seen. So it's like this weird new take on the Phantom Hitchhiker thing. But then you've got this report of Jack Patrick.
He hot.
Yeah, exactly. He hot. So that's exactly what's going on. So what is this all about, right? You know, why? Is it about this particular area? Is that why stuff is occurring? And maybe it is. You know, maybe it is. But I think this has got a little bit of a Crowley feel to it, right? And this was actually described by Ashley Walmsley, who was the daughter of Jeff. She says it's because in that TNT area, that after it was abandoned, after the Second World War, some people had come up with some really ridiculous, you know, ideas about, you know, what was occurring. So people were seeing these strange bird-like Mothman, which was originally called the Birdman, that was coming out of this particular site, this TNT area. But people were saying, oh, no, because it's got a whole heap of chemicals there, it's just some kind of chemically retarded bird. And it's like, or mutated bird.
Work.
And it's like, no. And the EPA did go in there years later, apparently, and remove 2 inches, 1 or 2 inches of topsoil because everything was contaminated with chemicals. But the type of, you know, mutations you're talking about don't cause
in the
a
cartoons.
Stalk.
No, that's the cartoons.
Exactly. To turn into a 7 foot tall, you know, massive winged, red eye glowing beast. Like, it's just not the answer. She thinks that something more Crowley-esque has taken place. And we know with the story of Crowley that he attempted to do a ritual inside his home on the banks of the Loch Ness, and it basically opened a portal that allowed all these entities to come through. She says, well, there's a lot of stories there of people doing exactly that. Take a listen.
Oh, you got another file for me.
I do.
Wasn't even ready.
Number 10.
I do know that in the 1980s and even before, the TNT area was a hub for a lot of occult type activity. You know, the activity in the TNT area for all those years, is it possible that maybe somebody did something to open up some kind of portal to let some kind of activity in? Why would it just choose Point Pleasant? Or there's all kinds of questions. Even John Keel himself thought that there was some kind of portal in the TNT area.
So he thought that there was some kind of portal there, and that comes down to the idea that people have been doing, you know, rituals of some kind. But where's like any evidence for that? You know, where's people saying, well, what they've seen? Well, it just so happens
that's why you've got this image.
She has a couple. Yeah, so that's why I've got that image. But she has a couple of reports from her own aunt who experienced something very disturbing in one of the igloos. So there's in this TNT area where they manufactured and stored the munitions.
Right. It's a satanic ritual image, by the way, for those of you listening.
Right. They were practicing some type of weird occult practice inside one of these igloos.
My dad's sister, I'm going to out her, but she snuck out in high school with a bunch of friends, went up to the TNT area. That's not unusual. A lot of people used to do that kind of thing. Inside the igloos that are up there, there's like 100 of these bunkers. Well, there's just a few of those that are open today, but people like to go up there and investigate and all that kind of stuff. Well, they had went into one and said that there was all these symbols written all over the walls, and there was a table with a outline of a cat, where somebody had sacrificed a cat. There was always stories that once a year that there was a large group of occultists that would come and meet. I know another girl that was one of my neighbors that lived up in that area that said that she was walking in the TNT area with her parents one day and said that she looked over and she seen this giant fire, and there was all these people in these hoods just like standing there around it. And she said she freaked out and ran off.
So what there's going
a lot of stories there that you could be like, well, you know, is that some really? Type of, you know, urban legend that's going on? And like you see a massive fire of people in robes just
I'm more skeptical of those stories than the giant hairy 7-foot owl creature.
And the whole, like, you know, the cat, you know, like outline on some type of altar. But then again, stranger things have happened. And it does tie in with, like I pointed out with Crowley, that people try to do these practices and these rituals to open dimensional doorways. Does it just so happen that this one particular area has already, because of the confluence of the rivers, it creates an energy field of some kind? Maybe it's something to do with that particular area of the earth, or the death and disaster and the horrible things that have taken place. It's allowed this thing to come into our reality. But maybe, like in the story of Linda, like where the thing was called, sometimes it can't get back. Sometimes it, you know, it gives people warnings. Sometimes it causes terror for people.
Well, if it's from the very dark pits of hell, then yeah, it probably would be cold when it comes
that's
to
our
dimension.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's actually a really, really good point. So look, I'll link to both the book and the documentary, both fantastic, in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org. Make sure you pick up the documentary. I believe it's available on iTunes. I think it's on Amazon as well, but I'll put a couple of links into the Mothman Legacy. Really excellent work. And of course, Nick Redfern's fantastic new book, Mothman and Other Flying Monsters, Nuclear Nightmares and Armageddon. It will all be in there. And maybe in our Plus section, or maybe even in the next show, I'll go into the elements of Mothman that become the dream invaders, where people have encounters with the Mothman in their dream, not connected to any of the nuclear nightmare stuff. This is where people have encounters with Mothman in their dreams. And then when they wake up, he's standing in their bedroom.
What?
Yeah, so pretty unsettling kind of stuff.
Hot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not so hot.
Is that related to my Sodom content coming up?
Maybe, Ben. Maybe it actually is.
Coming up after the break, exclusive for our Plus members, we're going to be looking
wallowing
at
in the jaws of Sodom.
The city of Sodom and Gomorrah, their destruction. Is there any truth to the biblical story? We know there's been a long time speculation over the real existence of the cities. But is there any truth to that hellfire from above that wiped them out?
Is there a big like salt lamp of a lady, like in a form of a lady somewhere?
That's what they found. Just Lot's wife who just could not resist. Could not resist. What if I just take a little peek? That's Discovering the City of Sodom. That's coming up after the break, exclusive to Plus. If you want to get access, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. You get access to the big extensions on the end of these shows every single Friday. And of course, Plus members get exclusive shows every single Tuesday as well. You're getting more than double the content if you sign up for Plus. Members also get an entirely ad-free version of the show. You get a higher bitrate version of the show as well. So you get a higher quality MP3. And of course, Plus members get access to our full videos as well on the website, mysteriousuniverse.org. And if you sign up for MU Max, you get access to our 15 plus years of audio back catalogue. It's all there. Sign up today, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. That's a wrap for this free edition of the show. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Radio Plus extension. Great to have.